This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to The Morning Run. It is Friday, the 20th of May, 6 o'clock in the morning. And I'm Melissa Idris, keeping you company all the way till 10 o'clock with Sharad Kutan, Ibrahim Sani, and we'll also have Julian Ng joining us a little later today. Good morning, gentlemen. My favourite men in the morning.
I thought you were going to say your favourite day of the week.
Yeah,
that's true. That is also true. That is also
true. So you're in good company on a good day, I suppose.
Yes.
Happy Friday, everyone.
Okay, well, just sit back and enjoy the show. We're going to take you all the way to 10 o'clock with really great programming. Today on The Breakfast Grill, we've got another panel today, but it's a Kopitiam economy panel. And what I mean by that is, of course, when we often talk about the volatile business climate, the volatile economic climate for big businesses and CEOs, we talk to them regularly on The Breakfast Grill. But what about smaller businesses? I mean, they're also feeling the pinch. So food and service operators like coffee shops and mamas, which are such a huge part of our lives anyway. So today we're going to be discussing issues like how GST, subsidies, foreign labour, inflation, how all that has perhaps affected, you know, food operators like coffee shops and mamak stalls.
Yeah, I wonder why we haven't developed a culture where we invite people home and have those late night supper and conversation at home rather than you know, in these public spaces.
I have to say, I haven't done it in a long time, but I sorely miss my late night teh tarik sessions with my friends, because, you know, sometimes it can be the most frivolous of conversations, but then it can go super deep, and then we share life stories and our philosophies and our worldviews.
Why can't you do that in your living room?
We could, but there's something really lovely about being able to do that at a restaurant that's open 24 hours. There's something uniquely Malaysian about that. And I really love it. And I see other people in the next table who are out. And
yeah, because in many countries, you can't get people to work those hours for those horrible wages.
That's true.
Right. So I think the ability to exploit foreign labor is essential to that culture, don't you think?
Yeah,
that's one level.
The thing is, even though I have to wake up very early on a weekday, I still force myself for this late night data sessions, right? Over the weekend, I mean, and I think it's extremely important for us to be cognizant that this is not just a uniquely Malaysian thing. We've been served at these mamak by foreign labourers. We are seeing a substantial rise in prices at the shops. It used to be a ringgit 50 cent for teh tarik. Now, some places sell sometimes 3 ringgit 4 ringgit.
Do you know how... I love how Malaysians tend to measure everything against the price of a roti canai. You know, there's a Big Mac index, right? But for Malaysians, it's always, roti canai went up already, mm-hmm. means, you know, the cost of living has gone up. And I love how we do that. And I have to say, roti canai growing up, in my childhood days in Penang, it was 35, 40 cents. And I remember going to buy that for breakfast every day.
Yeah. I think when Melissa meant
unnutritious breakfast.
When Melissa said it was uniquely Malaysian, she didn't mean that the people at the stalls are Malaysian.
No, the practice of benchmarking our cost of living.
And of course, you'd think of Singapore as another country where, and like Singapore maybe in cultural terms is never seen as different from Malaysia, but I think there are countries around the region also where going out and meeting at a public space, like the tea shop of Burma, right? So Burma has that institution. People gather around the tea shops and they have, you know, their what they call this preserved tea that they have, you know, lepet, and they eat it with their tea and, you know.
Is it often done in the late evening?
I think when the sun goes down, I think that's the other thing. People like to hang out under the stars, and you know, the old mamaks would have been a stall, and then all these tables and chairs that didn't necessarily have a roof, or it wasn't necessarily in a, you know, shop house. And in fact, I think most of the mamak shop houses that I've been to are horrible because there's, you know, lacks ventilation, it's always too hot.
But you sit outside. I love the fact that you're actually essentially sitting on the road. I mean, it's completely dangerous and perhaps against regulation, but I love the plastic chairs and the sticky tables and eavesdropping in the next table. I love all those things.
So, I got a bunch of friends that came from Bangladesh. And after that fancy lunch and a very humble dinner, I brought them out for a late night bola at Mama in Tamantun. And they said, oh my God, there's a lot of people here and it's like 2 a.m. I said, this is what Malaysia is, and we call this lepak. And they said that this is happening there as well with chai, tea, and they call it adda in Dhaka. So I guess there is a scenario where, and then he says, no wonder I can see the relevance of migrant workers from Bangladesh coming over to Malaysia, because they're already doing it back home. It's just that they're doing it again here in Malaysia. So it's not that much of a difference.
I can't imagine people sort of having tea at 2 a.m. when they have to work the next day.
Yes,
at 8. Yeah. So, I mean,
I often wonder that too.
Yeah, because I imagine university students and maybe the self-employed
people
or
in
taxi
transition
driver, you know,
of
taking
jobs.
A break. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, because I'm wondering who can afford to be out so late if they have to actually get... No, they have to get up, they have to go to work and presumably function.
Function, yes, and perform. Of course, so the reason why we're talking about mamak shops and coffee shops, because that's what's going to be our... That is going to be our focus on the panel for the Breakfast Grill today. We've got Ho Su Mong, President of the Malaysia-Singapore Coffee Shop Proprietors General Association, with Nurul Hassan Saul Hamid, President of the Malaysian Muslim Restaurant Owners Association, or better known as PRISMA.
Interesting. So, Malaysia-Singapore Association.
Yes.
How many associations of that sort still exist? The Malaysia-Singapore, you know, cross-boundary, transnational associations.
Yeah, for sure. And they've been very vocal in the recent months in the papers today. So, really good to have them on the panel. So, make sure you stay tuned for the Breakfast Grill for our Kopitiam Economy Breakfast Grill. That's at 8 o'clock. And after that, we've also got the Malaysian Health Ministry redoubling efforts to combat dengue this year. And they've launched a 2-month enforcement activity that ends this June. So on current affairs, we're going to be looking at the progress the ministry officials have seen, as well as the challenges that they've faced in carrying out this activity.
Yeah, so it's important to note that the Zika virus is being carried by the same agent as the dengue virus, which is the Aedes mosquito. And while dengue is confined to just mosquito bite, Zika can be transferred, the debate is still open, I suppose, through sexual transmission and also blood transfusion. So I think the fact that the health ministry is combating dengue this year is actually hitting two stones with one bird. Sorry, two birds with
one stone.
Yeah. So, or two mosquitoes with
one
health
SWAT.
Ministry. Yeah. So I think this is extremely timely and extremely important for us to look at.
Okay, and on the Property Show, every Friday we have the Property Show. This week's episode, we focus on first-time buyers who are generally put off by the current property prices that seem quite high. And this means that they get into the market later and later, and prices spiraling upwards seem always out of reach. So we speak to Siva Shankar, former president of MIEA, for his advice, and he has a solution to this problem. He says, buy now and buy something cheap. Find out more on the Property Show.
It's going to be
very
fun.
Very cryptic advice there, Siva Shankar.
Yeah, you know, I'm just talking to the property agent who sold me my apartment last year, and I was asking about apartments in the block I'm in, and he says, well, you know, it's not moving, but prices aren't coming down very much either. And part of the reason is some of the people who are selling their properties have deep pockets, have already paid off for these properties and are, you know, are looking for a good price, and they're not going to sell unless they get that price, even if it means waiting around.
Okay, so Property Show is going to be that advice for you. If you find yourself in the same predicament, this is the show for you. 9:35 a.m. is when you should be tuning in. But now, 6:09, let's take a quick look at the news update. Of course, we've all been following the tragedy of the Egypt Air jetliner, which was carrying 66 people from Paris to Cairo. Apparently, it had abruptly swerved, vanished from radar, and plunged into the Mediterranean early yesterday, shortly before it was scheduled to land. Now, Egyptian officials said the wreckage had been found and suggested terrorism was more likely cause than technical failure. However, the latest update on this is, according to CNN, Egypt Air's vice chairman, Ahmed Adil, said that the debris they found in the Mediterranean Sea is not from Flight 800. They say they stand corrected on finding the wreckage because what we identified is not part of our plane. So the search and rescue is still ongoing.
You know, this is something very critical for us to understand because this is the second tragedy in 7 months that a plane went down in the Sinai area and also in the Mediterranean area. And of course, ISIS took responsibility 7 months ago in the downing of a jet in the Sinai area. If this is also, in this case, another terrorist attack, I think this is clearly something that has to be remedied very quickly, because this is targeting the innocent and this is targeting the non-belligerents, people that have nothing to do with the kind of squabble that is happening
right now.
Yeah,
well, civilian air travel used to be sacrosanct, right? You never touched civilian. That's not part of the fight, as you said, Ibrahim. So I'm so it's really disheartening to see that how many airlines have now, in so recent years, been part of multiple tragedies involving terrorism. And I thought that,
the whole point of terrorism was, in fact, to target non-combatants. I think that was the main thing, right? Because that's what it's about. It's about terror. It's about striking terror in the general population. Mm. Right?
Well, I think now the questions still remain as to what happened. And I think we're going to keep you abreast on any latest developments about this on the news bulletins every half an hour in the morning. So make sure you stay tuned for that. And let's take a quick look at local politics. Has had a little bit of a kerfuffle yesterday. So it emerged from PKR's Rafizi Ramli, his WhatsApp chat, saying that he received complaints that money and women were demanded in negotiations with the Selangor state government.
Yeah, so it was a WhatsApp chat that was leaked to or obtained by something called the Malaysian Mirror. And Rafizi has refused to either deny or confirm that it is authentic WhatsApp. But what he does go on to say is that it's true that he's received complaints and that of the sort that, you know, the demands for, well, basically when you say women, they mean sex. So sex and money as part of the negotiations for imagined contracts. And the other thing he says is he's investigating the matter. Because the question to ask is this matter purely for the party, or is it a matter that, say, the MACC should take up? Because presumably the demands lead to government officials, and so this must fall under corrupt practices.
Yeah, and I think this is a big problem for PR to deal with in general. I think Rafizi has went against the grain of PKR twice this week. This is the second time he has done so. The first time was, of course, on Sunday, where the 8-page letter that Anwar supposedly wrote in prison that criticised Azmin and the gang for, you know, going in cahoots with Mahathir on the declaration rakyat. And I think there's something deeper brewing between Rafizi Ramli and the rest of the PKR establishment.
Well, there was also something brewing with Azmin Ali. He apparently had to deny reports that he had issued an ultimatum to state excos from PAS to resign if their party insisted on contesting the Sungai Besar by-election. So that was the report that came out, that he had issued this ultimatum. He has come out to strongly deny it. In fact, he called it slanderous.
Yeah, and he's saying that they are still in negotiations. This is with regard to the by-elections in Kuala Kangsar and Sungai Besar. However, everyone right now knows that in Kuala Kangsar it would be a straight fight. The problem is in Sungai Besar. It's not just PAS and Amanah trying to get the seat there. It's also PKR right now. And I think Azmin Ali has a lot to untangle with in terms of trying to determine who should stand for elections there.
What's very interesting in this debate, of course, is that Dr. Mahathir has come out to say that the federal opposition, you know, that, sorry, rather, the Barisan Nasional remains in power because the federal oppositions always fail to be united. Mm. And I think what Azmin is trying to do as a pragmatist is to get all sides to kind of see the larger picture. I imagine that might be his purpose, right? And so finding some accommodation, some point in which everybody can agree would be a really good step for what has become what once was a cohesive force into what has become now a very fractured force in terms of the federal opposition.
6:20 in the morning right now. And a quick note to say that Molly Schaefer, who was one of the most celebrated TV journalists, a big name in 60 Minutes, he has passed away at the age of 84. I don't know. I've never been a huge follower of 60 Minutes, but I know of him and his reputation, and I know of the show. Apparently, he's been on the show for 46 years.
Yeah, so when I was growing up in Johor Bahru, I watched 60 Minutes a lot on the TCS network in Singapore, and Molly Schaefer was one of those people that you know that I really looked at, you know, right after David Letterman and Stephen Colbert. So, I mean, at that time, it wasn't Stephen Colbert, it was Jay Leno, I suppose, yeah. So
we come from very different generations. When I was watching 60 Minutes, you didn't have those alternatives. I mean, really, the idea of presenting news through humor. Actually, there was something called not the 9 o'clock news. I think that was some that came from Britain.
Hugh Laurie and Steve Fry.
Yeah, but Stephen Fry, but not. It wasn't shown in Malaysia or in Singapore, I think, at that time. Yeah. So the kind of serious journalism with those interviews and those background reports, there were all these individuals. I don't know to what extent you know, American journalism has shaped our demands of our media. And I think that would be kind of an interesting question to ask, because we have been exposed, I guess, you know, several generations to American journalism. I think for me, the more the other dimension of it was the kind of mythic ones and the Lou Grant show and those kind of like television shows that were based in newsrooms. And, and so you kind of imagine that's what journalism really is, when it might have been completely romanticized.
Yeah, you know, while he died at 84, it still doesn't stop the fact that 2016 did take many lives of our celebrities, former singers and former journalists. And I think that trend is really damaging.
So he, after 46 years, just retired from the show, right? So
A week ago.
He retired a week ago and passed away. Clearly, 60 Minutes being his really the legacy of his life.
Yeah, clearly retirement's not good for your health.
Not good for your health.
And he has 919 broadcasts of of 60 Minutes, and he joined in 1970. So yeah, 46 years, Melissa.
So Melissa, can you imagine yourself, you know, 40 years from now, you know, having this kind of resume? It's like, you know, the voice of BFM's morning show, you know, Melissa Idris finally retires
a week
at the age of, you know 80,
I can
whatever.
See employers sending this around saying, retirement is not good for you. Keep on working. Keep on working. All right, 6:24 right now. Let's take a quick look at some other interesting stories that have piqued our interest this morning. One from the BBC to point out that perhaps it's been the long perceived wisdom that a good leader is a decisive one, that he or she knows their own mind and is quick to make the correct call. So what if this commonly held opinion is wrong? Would it actually be better to put someone in charge who is a procrastinator, someone who puts off coming to a decision? Because that is the opinion of business psychologist Professor Adam Grant, who explores the issue in his recent book.
Yeah, that recent book is called Originals, How Nonconformists See the World. There is some truth to this, because a rushed decision, while it is a decision nonetheless, is made in a hasty manner. And I think...
well done. So that's just kind of defining... I mean, the rushed decision is a rushed decision. Thank you very much. But the issue is whether it's an effective one. And there might be decisions that have to be made in a rush, and that might be...
Like going for lunch? Or?
Whether, you know,
in time,
you're
going
to sign off on a, you know, on on something that needs to go to the printers, for instance.
Okay, so so in a nutshell, for me, I think that there's a time to make a to be decisive, and there's a time to perhaps let it percolate a little bit longer, you know, not to be so knee-jerk reactive. But I don't know, what do we look in our look for in our leaders? Do we want someone who is strong and decisive and takes a stand about something and stays to it? Or can we respect someone who says, I can't deal with this right now, I need time to think about it. We're not going to make a decision on this until I've had some time to deliberate on the matter.
Yeah, so we spoke about this very recently. It's called the Elon Musk doctrine or Musk doctrine. And he is always running behind schedule.
Well, that's slightly different though, because he, I think, does that. So the Musk doctrine is essentially he sets an ambitious deadline and he misses that deadline and then he says I'll do it later
deliberately
misses the deadline and then everyone then expectations sort of roll over and he goes I'm gonna do this now, so he's kind of messing with people's
minds. Okay, on Elon Musk though, I do remember reading about him and how he, you know, he demanded complete and utter demands utter loyalty, and that his secretary, you know, of many, many years, who finally asked him for extra, you know, days off, was fired summarily because she did that. And so, you know, so he's also given to these rather impetuous kind of, moments where he and fires somebody. And that's the question, right? I mean, when firing somebody, in making decisions about somebody's, place in an organization, should you move quickly or should you move, in a slow and deliberate fashion?
Yeah, so that's, I think, the question we're asking this morning. Are the best bosses the one who put off difficult decisions? Tell us what you want from your boss. Would you mind a boss who put off difficult decisions for time to think the matter through? 016-201-9000 is the number to text or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Or if you're a boss yourself and you want to share your opinion on how you do things, yeah, why not? So when I was back in the banking days, putting off decisions would be one of the more problematic thing that I have to deal with. Again, it's because it's not because of what we want. It's because sometimes our customers want, our clients, our regulators. But these bosses don't feel that pressure.
Can I ask whether putting off big decisions can be seen as a sign of weakness in a leader?
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, you often look for someone who knows his or her own mind, right? Who knows, you know, to take things decisively. But someone who is seen to kind of shrug, it can be perceived as someone who's shrugging responsibility or someone who is weak in decision making, for instance. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think shirking responsibility, being soft, I mean, these are all kinds of accusations. But I think what's worse when people make decisions is, for the subordinates, is to feel that decisions aren't being made with the full facts before the person making decisions. So your boss has made a decision, but he or she wasn't aware or in command of all the facts that were necessary to be weighed for that decision to be made, right? And so I think that's the other side of the coin. You want decisions to be made, but you also want them to be made in the best possible manner.
But like for banking, right, Ibrahim, time is money.
And absolutely.
If you kind of sit back and really weigh the decision, you might lose that opportunity, that deal to a competitor.
Yeah, and that competitor will always make a faster decision than you will. That's the that's how I feel, actually, when I was there doing banking stuff. But yeah, I at the same time, there's something on to that, Sharad. You were saying that you need to have full facts before you pull that trigger. But at the same time, you know, timeliness is of the essence, right? I mean, sometimes you even with sufficient facts, you may not need all of them. Isn't that enough for you to make a decision?
I think there's a line that needs to be drawn. I think at some point you have to kind of realize you have to make a decision. So not procrastinating for too long a time. That's a fine line, trying to figure out the when you need to, you know, sit down and make a decision. I do think though that we all need to sometimes take a beat and think about the decisions we're making. More often than not, decisions can be knee-jerk responses, and it's always good to take a little leaf out of this page and procrastinate for a short while on decision making.
Right. So the thing about the book is that it was put together by people who, by someone who actually interviewed people who did those decisions. So very interesting book. We'll tweet out the link to it.
Fantastic. BFM 89.9, Eric Clapton there with Crossroads. Time to play air guitar in the car.
Yeah. And in the studio, I mean, you know, we're just jamming away.
Of course. Right now, it's 6:40 in the morning. It's when Friday, the 20th of May. Melissa, Sharad and Ibrahim here with you this morning. Now, Jay Weinstein is a photographer that loves taking photos of people from different cultures. He's quite famous for taking photos in India. He loves it there. He often captures smiling and unsmiling versions of people. And this is to help them discover something about themselves, because he believes that a face is transformed by a smile. So we're going to tweet out this link to this article where it shows two portraits of the same person side by side, one a serious expression and another of the person smiling. And you can really see the transformative nature of a smile.
I think it's, you know, also important to note that in some countries, smiles are associated with their branding, right? So you can think of Thailand yeah. Land of Smiles, or even Singapore during a period when they were promoting tourism, saying, and they had a campaign directed at Singapore and saying, smile, because, you know, your smile is worth or part of $1 billion industry. And so you might wonder whether in Singapore, at least, there are concerns about sincerity.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, even with the Thai Land of Smiles things, because there's something infantilizing about the smile thing. All these happy people in Thailand. And there have been Thai artists who've taken up, one Thai artist in particular, taken up this whole question of the smile and the Land of Smiles brand, and put something a little menacing in the smile. And so, you know, when I've seen these portraits, these huge portraits of smiling Thais, there was something in the eyes, something in the turn of the lips that was slightly menacing. And I think he was trying to humanize this rather flat image of the smiling Thai.
Well, this article really got me thinking about why we smile in photographs. You know, the need to capture a moment that is profoundly happy or superficially happy, you might even argue. And it kind of just made me think a little bit more about smiling photographs. Because if you think back, smiling in photographs is not that... that doesn't go back that far. You know, if you remember all the old photos, the Victorian photos perhaps...
I'm not that old, but I know Melissa's looking at me and saying, you know, think back to the time of Queen Victoria.
Tell us about your time.
Photos of old Victorian photographs, of course, you remember really serious portraits, right?
Yeah.
So then it made me think, why are those old photographs so much more moving than the photographs we see today? The smiling selfies, for instance. You know, it doesn't have the same kind of gravitas You know what I mean?
Okay, so when you travel around the world and you encounter different cultures, it's clear that people do respond quite differently. And I do know that some places people smile, and some places you're told, please don't make eye contact with strangers. It's dangerous. You know, a couple of years ago, I was in Finland and I was surprised by, you know, I went to a bar with a friend and the waiters did not smile. In fact, I felt this, you know, there wasn't the kind of thing I expect from, you know, service staff, which is at least, I mean, whether they mean it or not, it doesn't matter. But at least they were friendly, bubbly, or, you know, inquisitive, or, you know, but
at least
nothing.
Interested.
In Finland, in Helsinki at least, you know, people don't seem to smile so readily.
Well, you know, fashion models don't smile. When they trot down the runway, they don't smile. And I've always wondered, why do they look so angry all the time?
Yeah.
Apparently, smiling detracts attention away from the clothes. So when you're smiling as a fashion model, people are looking at your face. They're drawn to your face. They're drawn to the smile.
So you want to ask me my personal experience as a fashion model?
Yes, that's looking at you, Sharad. But that's one of the reasons why they're told to keep a really serious expression on their face, so that spectators can focus on the design of the clothes and the beauty of the clothes rather than the beauty of the model.
You know, this is fantastic. That means if we, while we smile, that's because we want to attract attention all the way to our face. We don't want the scenario, the circumstances, the event, the venue, whatever. We just want people to actually focus on our face, our faces with our friends in that photograph.
But it's transformative, right? So a photo of, say, Sherrod scowling, as he is at me right now. And a photo of Sherrod smiling. Yeah. You know, we are drawn to the ones that have the smile.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Vic, when you think of, you know, our the way we respond to children, for example, babies, we try to get the babies to smile at us, right? And so we do all kinds of things. We make faces in order for the child, because we think of the smile as being the most positive response. But coming back to this particular, sorry, I'm going to tweet this out.
Please
is
do.
That I think the idea of capturing the image of people in countries other than your own and cultures other than your own, that often the non-smiling picture has this kind of gravitas,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
It sort of nails the exotic nature of the other. You feel that, oh, these are from people from a different land. But as soon as they smile, I think dissolves a little, right?
They become human.
Yeah, I mean, have you ever seen any, like, you know, Nazi pictures where those guys smiled? I can't imagine anything.
I actually did. I have. I went to the Holocaust Museum in Washington D.C. and I remember seeing this really disturbing photo of Nazis, the people who were at Auschwitz. And they were having a picnic, and they were laughing, and they were smiling, and they were, I think there was a musical instrument in that photo. But it really kind of, it bothered me. It was so unsettling.
It's bothering me now.
It showed that they were just like all of us, wanting to have a good time, laughing with friends, but yet you know what they're capable of, what they've done.
But you know, this would be true of any human population,
right?
That's
true, right? But that's why I think that photograph was really powerful for me.
I mean, you think about a place like Bali. I think it's a popular destination for a lot of Malaysians, and we think of Bali as a land of smiles and gentle people. But during the period, the anti-communist push in Indonesia, 65, Bali was, apart from Java, one of the areas with the highest rates of murder.
Yeah.
And that had to do with a lot of the caste tensions and class tensions in Bali. So the attack against the Communist Party, the bloodletting against the Communist Party and its members was tremendous in Bali. And so you think, oh, how did gentle people with their gentle smiles produce such violence? And I think it's because, well, at the bottom of it all is we're all human beings. We're capable of a whole range of emotions and things as terrible as the Nazis did, right?
Yeah, so there's this TV show, Lie to Me. It's based on the behavioral psychologist, actually psychiatrist as well. And this guy, Paul Ekman, he codified the 7 major expressions of a human. And one of them is anger, disgust, that kind of stuff, right? And Paul Ekman says that with a smile, it basically doesn't do much in masking the real other emotions that you have, including contempt.
So do you always smile in photos? Do you guys always smile in photos?
No, I don't. And I think sometimes I feel I'm forced to smile in a kind of cheesy fashion.
Yeah.
The exaggerated smile is a way of smiling without really necessarily meaning what you're doing.
I'm going to be all mushy about this because my wife remarked this. She said that if it's just you, you don't smile, but with your kids, you smile a lot. And there's a lot of pictures
That's lovely. I do think that sometimes we do want to capture a photo with everyone smiling because we want to remember that situation as a happy moment. But I also think, you know, sometimes I fall in love with the candid shots, the shots of someone frowning or with the mouth slightly open. Or as Sherrod would sometimes say, the resting bitch face, you know?
Right. Yeah, there you go.
Well, I would say that is actually a term.
That's a term. We were talking about that the other day. But I do I do like that. I find beauty in that because there's such, you know, that's your natural state, and it's not forced in any way.
And then that natural state, when it's immortalized in a photograph, means a lot more than that fake smile that you put on.
Yeah, I do.
Well, you know, talk about fake and not fake, but this story comes from a website called OurBetterWorld.org, and it's actually sponsored by the Singapore International Foundation, a foundation that was set up to connect the Singaporean diaspora with the motherland, as it were. So that's the other side of this interesting story, which has to do with being positive about the world and also making connections.
Well, it's Friday. I guess we can be positive about everything right
positive
now.
About the weekend. 6:49, just turning 6:50 right now. Coming up is Family Affair by Sly and the Family Stone. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.